I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Motorsports Season Review Awards, in association with Pocker 1/8 Model Kits.
Hello, and welcome to the Motorsports F1 Season Review Podcast. We're going to be looking back at a landmark season, at least for records, if not for unpredictable results. I'm your host, Damien Smith, and I'm delighted that we're joined today by two special guests. The first is a very familiar voice to motorsport listeners, Mark Hughes, Grand Prix editor of the magazine and the writer of a superb new Verstappen biography. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi, Damien. Yes, it's very kind. Thank you.
I enjoyed reading.
Oh, good.
I haven't seen you for a while. The listeners won't be able to tell, but you're very hirsute these days. How long has that been around for?
Oh, it's just a winter one. It's coming off before the season starts. Yeah. Came out the wrong colour. Came out all white. I don't know how that's happened.
Strange, that, isn't it? Very old. Yeah. Very old. Yes. Okay. Well, good to see you, Mark. Our second special guest is, of course, Alex Brundle, racing driver and broadcaster. Alex, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's great to join you finally on one of these podcasts. I know we've been talking about it for a little while, so it'll be good to debate the ins and outs of the Formula One season.
Yeah, and our paths have crossed a couple of times this year. A couple of weeks ago I saw you, but you actually provided one of the highlights of my season, driving that Ferrari 512 at the Silverstone Festival. What was that like?
Well, it was probably one of the highlights of your season. It's probably one of the highlights of my life, I must admit, driving that thing. A brilliant piece of kit. Thank you to the owner of that, who I'm not sure whether they will welcome or would rather not be named specifically on an unconnected podcast. But yeah, I mean, Ferrari V12 doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, absolutely not. No. Well, let's crack on with the podcast. We're going to do a review of the season team by team. So I thought we'd just go through them in constructor's order. So we're obviously starting at the top with that team, Red Bull Racing, that have just dominated the season. Mark, can I start with you? You know, this team never settles for what they had the previous year. They moved the game on yet again. What was it about them that impressed you this year?
Just that. It would have been very easy just to, given their advantage the year before, just to sort of tweak it a little bit and know that they probably would have still had something with which would have been good enough for Max to deliver them another championship, but they didn't. They've although looked at a casual glance pretty much like last year's car it was, and when you looked into the detail of it, it was a deeper chassis, it had the different suspension, the aerodynamics were balanced in a quite different way. It's probably when you look at the comparisons where you can, at the tracks where you sort of got a reasonable read on it, it looked like it was about a second a lap faster than last year's car, despite the regulation change, which should have added about half a second to the lap time. So, you know, they clawed the half a second of the regulation change back and took another second as well. And then that was, you know, given how much pace they had to start with, that was incredibly impressive.
Yes, it was. Alex, I mean, we knew they were going to come out of the blocks as the favourites. Were you surprised at just how dominant they were this year?
I think I was. I think the main thing that surprised me was how little everybody else was able to do to catch up, frankly. You know, you've got several teams, we'll probably come on to, through the mid-year, who made big jumps forward in terms of performance. But when you get to the end of the Grand Prix season, where you've got a car that has been dominant all year, you've got a cost cap. Yeah, okay, you've got limitations on resource, and those teams are racing all of the time. But there were several occurrences through the year where the concept of that Red Bull was clear to see for the rest of the field. And what truly impressed me is you've got a dominant car year long, meaning that not only have they managed to find a concept that works, roll the concept forward that works, obviously with some adjustments that Mark just went into, but they've also managed to sort of defend the realm, if you like, of that concept and keep everyone else at bay, which is, I think, what's most impressive about it.
Yeah, and you know, this isn't a one-person team. It's not all about Adrian Newey, but he is the common denominator in this era of success and in so many other eras as well. Mark, I mean, can you just explain a little bit about how this team works and how he operates and how he manages to find what other teams don't?
Yeah, I mean, Adrian's quite a self-effacing individual. He's not somebody that stands up and says, right, follow me, men, and then heads off in the battle. He's just has this creative brain, and he will say something like, you know, he feeds into that technical group. And I mean, it's the head of Aero, Enrico Balbo, and you've got the tech director, Pierre Vache. They're the critical people that keep that structure in place. And Adrian feeds into that. And certainly at a time of regulation change, so going back, you know, a year and a bit when the new ground effect regs were coming into effect, I can imagine that he would be very, very valuable in not only because he had previous ground effect experience at the very end of the last ground effect formula, but also just in the way he thinks about things. When you throw all the variables up in the air and say, okay, find the ultimate from that, he is that. That's what he does better than anybody else. And if you look at what makes that car, the concept of both the RB18 and the RB19 different, it was the way that it could combine the suspension platform with the aero platform in a way that it you never saw the thing bouncing in either of the two seasons. I think it bounced once in their pre-season testing in 2018, and they fixed it, and that was that. But it's clearly in his mind how the whole concept of the aero map has to work in combination with the suspension, and this has become much, much more important, crucially important in this set of regulations than previous ones, where you fitted the suspension in around the aerodynamics, and then that was all it was to it, really. It's a much more subtle game than that now, and I think it was significant that Adrian himself said, "I'll do the suspension, I'll design the suspension," and you know, when you look at parts that the tech directors actually design, it's very rarely they can point to a part, and I think that would have been true even of Adrian's career. But he specifically said, no, I did do the suspension on the RB18 front and rear suspension. And there's a reason for that. And I think that is built into the DNA of the car and the advantage of the last 2 years.
And speaking of his career, I mean, do you think it is a factor that he has that very distant experience of ground effects from the beginning of his career at Fittipaldi and March?
Oh, for sure, it's part of it. It's part of all the different things that feed into that the brain ticking over and thinking, you know, that's definitely one of the things, just like working on the ovals with Mario Andretti or Bobby Rahal, is all these things are just feeding in. He's vastly experienced as well as very talented. So yeah, for sure he would have been, or he was aware, we talked about it, of the possible hazard of bouncing and porpoising. And that will have been part of what he was thinking of in terms of the shape of the aero map and how the you know, the tunnels should be a bit more forgiving than perhaps what the theoretical ultimate shaping would be.
Yeah. Alex, let's move on to the drivers. Verstappen and Sergio Perez, obviously heavily contrasting seasons, despite the fact they finished 1-2 in the championship. You know, Verstappen came into the year as a fully formed two-time world champion, obviously one of the greats of his era, and certainly probably one of the greats of all time as well. And that reputation only seemed to be enhanced through this year, didn't it? What did you make of Verstappen's year?
It's interesting because those two drivers for me were caricatures almost of two different drivers, almost a combination of two different drivers I've seen throughout my motorsports career. The driver full of confidence, and Verstappen embodies the driver full of confidence. I've seen it in sports car teams when you have one driver who's clearly faster than their lineup, but I've also seen it in single seater teams where you've got, like between Verstappen and Perez, one driver who is clearly clear of their teammate. The way they walk, the way they talk, the way they operate in the team, the jests over the radio, the back slapping in the pit garage, and all of the sort of general banter that goes along with the best favorite. You know, that's what Max Verstappen really embodies for me. Counteracted or juxtaposed, I guess, against another driver I've seen throughout my career. And it was characterized best, I think, in the final stages of the season in Interlagos, where Perez lost out to Fernando Alonso, and then in Vegas, where he lost out to Leclerc. The driver who's entirely lost that confidence and has had it beaten out of them by having to turn up every Friday, every Saturday, every Sunday across a long season of races and endlessly engage with where they've been beaten the day before. And that is something that is incredibly confidence sapping. The moment for me on that, alongside those on track moments, were when Sergio came into the pits. I remember standing on top of the pit garage. I was doing work for F1 TV in Suzuka. And I looked down as they wheeled Sergio back into the pit box, having retired the car for the first time. And his eyes were just shocked. There was the shock of an amateur driver who's just had a crash in the night at Le Mans. I cannot believe what the sequence of events that have just occurred. And so it was really interesting for me to watch those two drivers represent the winner and the loser within a racing organization throughout the year. But obviously, the car from Adrian, what really impresses me about Adrian is exactly as you were saying, Mark, he takes control of the elements of the car that require his attention. So when you moved into the era of energy systems, the packaging, when you read through his book, How to Build a Car, which is a brilliant read, I would recommend it to anyone. The control of the energy system packaging in early energy system cars, and then now the control of the downforce application to the tire surface, which is the dominant factor in management of the Pirelli tire, are things that he takes a stranglehold of, recognizes what's important, and appears to just be able to massage those factors. So I think, you know, the car's the star, and the two drivers were characters within the play.
Mark, Perez, hugely experienced at this stage of his career, and we know how, you know, he's a very effective Grand Prix driver. The way he started the season, there was even some talk that this could be a genuine push for the title against Verstappen in the same team. Always seemed a bit like wishful thinking to me, and so it proved. But
Perez, even assuming you would be in the same league, I think that really you saw Max take a step up in performance there. And in Miami, he just wiped the floor with him from, you know, a long way back on the grid. And that was it, really. And I think it was a real body blow for Perez, that, I think, Miami. And I didn't see his head come back up after that. And then the car developed, as it always will do, in a way that Max prefers, and that worked against Checo too. And it all just, you know, it just got into a vicious cycle, and it turned out just like the other seasons. And that must be very hard to take. You know, in Zandvoort, where he made a lap on stop for Inters, which was absolutely the right call, it bought him 14 seconds on Verstappen, just the way that the conditions were. You should not be losing a race to a guy in the same car that once you've got 14 seconds on him. But Max just did it, just took 2 seconds a lap out of him for a few laps, then undercut him at the stops, then pulled away. And so that, you know, just how do you bounce back from that?
Well, we'll come back to Red Bull in our part two of our motorsport season review podcast. We'll be talking about being award season. We'll be talking about season review awards, and they're obviously going to be up for Motorsports Team of the Year and Verstappen for Driver of the Year. But before we move on from Red Bull, can I just ask both of you briefly for a quick verdict was this a boring F1 season because of the domination that we saw from one team? Mark, first of all, you give us your verdict.
No, I'd never find any season boring. I mean, even when you have such a level of dominance, it's fascinating to understand why, and B, watch how it develops and how the others are dealing with that, and just watching that whole sequence play out, and watching a great driver and a top team absolutely at the top of the game, and being there witnessing history being made and records being broken. No, for me, it's never boring. It's just, they're just different. They just have different textures.
And Alex, your view on that one?
I think if it was, then we've done a bad job of it, because it was an interesting season, but not an interesting season if you present it in a surface manner, over TV, over in the written word, etc. So I think it was actually an incredibly exciting season of Formula One racing. When you look at several of the races, when you look at the battles throughout the pack, even to the end of the field, the millions and millions of dollars available to be won or lost through to the end of the season between constructors. So when you tell those stories, I think it was an incredibly exciting F1 season. But it's a failure in broadcasting, perhaps, or a failure in explanation. And with that failure in broadcasting and failure in explanation, it could be perceived as a bad one. So I guess it was down to us, and the audience will decide.
Absolutely. Good stuff. OK, well, let's move on. We've got lots more teams to talk through. Let's go on to Mercedes now. Now, they came out of a very disappointing first season with this rule set, telling us they'd learned their lessons, yet they were sticking with their concept. They were standing by it. That was proven to be a mistake very early on, and they've gone through another disappointing season, yet they're still second in the championship. So, you know, on the basis of results, that's not that disappointing. But for this team, you've got to say, Mark, that this was a poor season. What would you say to that?
Yeah, it was. And it's not one that they will be happy with at all. And they stuck with the basic aero layout of last year's car, and they thought they'd given it more appropriate rear suspension to get it away from the bouncing threshold, a bit more sophistication in the underbody design. They thought they'd unlock this potential that this car had, and they didn't. They concentrated on finding the downforce at high ride heights, where it's very difficult to find, and generally, didn't put priority on low ride height performance in the shape of their aero map, which just meant it had quite limited rear end grip in high speed corners. And there's something about the way the aero worked that made it very snappy and unpredictable into slow ones. So no sudden direction changes and no fast corners, thank you, which made it quite limited one-dimensional car, really. Mid-speed, long corners, it was good. Lewis Hamilton stuck it on pole in Budapest. But it was reluctant to switch on its front tyres as well, so it needed hard outlaps to get the front tyre temperatures. So that always put you at the mercy of track positioning, so you saw these wild swings between the two drivers as one hit that, threshold and the other one didn't. But generally, I think both Lewis Hamilton and George Russell were dealt a pretty mediocre hand by what Mercedes gave them this year.
Alex, let's put yourself in the driver's shoes here, Lewis Hamilton, George Russell. You as a racing driver, you know pretty early on when you first test a new racing car whether it's going to work or not. These two knew they were up against it all year. How did you think they responded to the challenge this year?
I think early days between those two, I thought and I saw that George would be able to, was so used to, because he was earlier into the phase of his driving career, was kind of more used to grabbing a car by the scruff of the neck and driving what he was given. Whereas Hamilton, we saw it all through the first year of the new Mercedes when it came out of the blocks, would basically go out, even in the early days of testing, go out, do a lap. If he wasn't happy with it, park it, go, you'll have to sort that. And then continue on. This year we've seen more errors from George, which has been uncharacteristic, I think, and something that I think is something he needs to nip in the bud, to be honest. Otherwise he's going to be considered as a bit of a nearly man throughout the season. But I would be frustrated if I was those Mercedes drivers. I think the concept of this car is built around the theory that they had that they would be able to control the rear ride height of the car as they always used to in their dominant era. And as such, but with all of the suspension elements that were banned and disallowed moving into this next phase of regulations, they then realized through the first year of them that they couldn't. And it always looked to me like, I mean, when the car first debuted in the Bahrain test, when we first saw it, it always looked to me like an incredibly pitch sensitive thing to drive. You see the car jump forward, drivers losing rear end grip and so on and so forth. I would be frustrated, particularly as George Russell, that the team maintained the confidence that they could make that concept work and didn't divert away from it earlier. And I would be pushing hard for that to have occurred. I mean, but at this stage of the year, I'd just be pleased to see the back of the thing. And I think they both are.
Absolutely. Mark, you've seen Lewis Hamilton throughout his Formula One career from the start all the way through. You've seen the peaks and the very few troughs that he's had. What impressed me particularly this year was that it looked to me as if he looked like someone who, if he's given the opportunity, he can still grab it. That eighth title, he still believes in it. He still believes it's possible. And there's no sign of a waning of the ability that he has. Do you agree with that? Would you say that he's still the force that he's always been?
I think potentially he is. I think you don't really see a driver able to extract everything that they've got until they're in a car which cooperates with them. So you sort of get a false ceiling a bit like we had with Max at the beginning of last year, where the Red Bull was a bit of an understeerer and Checo was pretty much as quick as him for a few races. It just places that false ceiling. And so, yeah, I don't think at every race this year you'd point to Lewis Hamilton and say that was Lewis Hamilton at his best. I don't think it was possible for him to be at his best for many of those races just because of the way the car behaves. But you give him a little sniff and there he is on pole position. And Budapest, there he is chasing Verstappen at Austin. You know, if the car is somewhere in the ballpark, all of a sudden he's switching on. So that's a good sign. I don't know. I'm not yet convinced how much longer he's prepared to wait for this to come to him, for the good car to come back. I think he has this sort of vision or dream that do you like to bounce back after everybody's written him off and it's still I rise sort of thing, you know, a bit like Muhammad Ali coming back after everybody thought he was a spent force. And I think that is what's keeping him going. Not necessarily the numbers, the eighth title, although that would obviously embody that vision. But just the idea of him coming back and being able to say, "There, I told you all." Even if nobody was thinking that I think he makes that sort of that narrative in his head to help him sort of push him forward, to fuel him. But you know, if Merck give him another, he's got two more years to do. If Merck give him another two cars like this, I don't see him sticking out a mediocre car after mediocre car in the way that Fernando Alonso did. I don't think his motivation comes from the same place.
No, that's interesting.
I've interviewed him twice this year throughout the after FP2, which is always a good teller because they've had a proper go at it. And they've had a proper feel of the car. The first time was in Singapore, where the car was pretty good. Obviously, Red Bull was struggling a little bit more. And the second time was in Suzuka. And I've never seen rage behind the eyes like when the car was not good enough in Suzuka. And I would quote that to anybody who says that Lewis has lost the motivation for it. And I've never seen joy like when it was good. I think the guy properly lives it every day and every week still. So I really wouldn't write him off for a while.
Yeah. Could either of you see him driving for anyone else? I chuckled when the Christian Horner text message came up. I mean, Alex, you were just shaking your head as I said that. You couldn't see him going anywhere else to have a try?
I mean, I think there's way too much water under the bridge at Red Bull. You know, anywhere else he might go is only ever going to be shooting distance of what an on-form Mercedes could offer him. And he's got so much of a head of steam. I think what we've seen this year between George and Lewis is actually a little bit of Lewis is utterly brilliant at making the team work for him as well, in the same way Fernando is. And in the same way, Max, I think within that Red Bull lineup is just because he's got so much head of steam there. And I think at this stage of his career now, a risk of losing that position of control to potentially get a little bit further up the road, I think he'll believe in himself to be able to move that team back to where they need to be before he'll opt for another option, really.
Okay, Mark, what's your thoughts? Is he Mercedes till he dies?
The big teams, the top teams, they've got their, you know, their main man already in there. You know, it's Ferrari, it's Leclerc, Red Bull, it's Verstappen, and you know, if you're thinking of swapping, you'd be thinking of either of those two, and you have to go in there and take it off the guy, or you know, at least make your position equal to theirs when they're the incumbent driver. And I don't see it that being the route to his eighth title.
No. Okay, let's move on to Ferrari. Mark, at this time last year, you were questioning how wise it was to replace Mattia Binotto with Fred Vasseur. How do you think Fred got on in his first year in the big job?
I think he got on really well. But it's, you know, he inherited the car that he had, and so he didn't have much say on that. But he calmed the team down. I think it was understandably very nervous and on its tippy toes a little bit after, you know, what had happened there behind the scenes with Binotto's departure. But he calmed it all down, and he just sort of gathered everyone around him, and they were still operationally a little bit scrappy, and you know, the couple of times Leclerc got grid penalties for infringing when his race engineer should have been on top of it, and there's a couple of questionable calls on tyre strategies, but you know, nothing, no howlers really, unless I've forgotten an obvious one. I don't think so.
No.
So operationally a bit better. The car wasn't bad, given that no one was anywhere near the Red Bull. They got 6 poles over the year. It was a very quick qualifying car. It had its limitations in the race. They stuck to their original concept, and it was, by their own admission, it was limited. It didn't have the headroom of the other concept, the Red Bull type concept, and basically they just ran out of airflow when they were trying to outwash the airflow around from the big bluff side pods at the front. And also to keep the floor fed as well. And it was at high speed, it was just running out. And you got this high speed snappiness, especially if you've got a crosswind, and the drivers really found that very difficult to deal with. So that was its limitation. But when everything was going well, it was a quick car. And they were a force to be reckoned with at various points in the season.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Alex, on the driver's perspective, they were, you know, Sainz and Leclerc very equally matched. Sainz obviously had that purple patch where he, you know, broke the Red Bull run and became the only other winner of the season in Singapore. Leclerc finished very strongly. What do you make of those two? They do seem to be one of the best matched pairings in on the grid at the moment.
I think they're a very well matched pairing, and in sort of their personality states as well, they're very much sort of on message for Ferrari, aren't they? They've had a few little snafus through the year. There's been some great side by side stuff, but they both seem to be relatively well on message. It was interesting to watch that car ebb and flow between the two of them. That high speed snappiness that Mark was just talking about. They had a go at curing it in the mid-year, and it was quite interesting. As the car became more understeery, then Leclerc struggled a little bit more with it, and then they kind of managed to sort that out, and it ebbed and flowed back. So I guess that was probably the most interesting thing between them. The tyre degradation was always an issue. They often found themselves a compound harder than other teams throughout the year. But they've got to try and get their race pace under control. I mean, it's clearly a quick race car, isn't it? It's clearly a quick qualifying car, which means that their aero concept can't be too far away. They've just got to find a way to make that work over the race stint. And clearly sticking that in the pair in the two drivers' excellent hands is not enough, and they're going to have to go back to the drawing board over the winter and make something that's sustainable over a Grand Prix distance.
Yes. So I knew that this would happen. Time is ticking on, and we've only got through the top three teams. We better push on. What I'd like to do next is let's talk about McLaren and Aston Martin, that battle for fourth place, and talk about them maybe a little bit together. Because one of them, obviously, in terms of Aston, started very strongly. McLaren started looking disastrously off the pace, and you know, James Key, the technical director, paid the price. But they had that incredible turnaround from Austria, certainly from Silverstone onwards, where Lando Norris actually led the British Grand Prix, and really after that, it swung McLaren's way. Mark, let's start with McLaren first of all, in terms of your perspective on them. You knew that those updates were coming. Were you surprised at how much they turned things around?
Well, for sure. I mean, there were very confident noises coming out of the team, but you know, that you have to take that with a pinch of salt. But they were, you know, they were saying, no, we believe we've got a second a lap coming. And you thought, well, that'd be a hell of an update. But yeah, it looks like they did have, essentially. And they knew, even as they launched the car in its original form, that wasn't going to work. And they had this parallel program going that wasn't quite ready to convert into a car at that point. And they twigged quite late in the day what they thought was a crucial difference in how you configured the underfloor and the side pods and all that part. So that required a big re-engineering job. And came in two parts, one in Baku and the second part in Austria. And that's, as you say, that's when it really switched on. And from there, sort of all the way through to Qatar, really, you'd say overall it was the second fastest car after the Red Bull. It was usually better than the Mercedes and the Ferrari. So, it was a fantastic turnaround, but it was one that was sort of made easier for them by the underperformance of Ferrari and Mercedes, I'd say.
Yes, that's a good point. And in the era of the balance, the budget cap as well, to do that mid-season was kind of, it was a complete surprise, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, in comparison, for example, to, you know, the slightly later update from AlphaTauri, which, you know, it was a little jump. We through that stage of the year, there were several teams that jumped on a big update package. And you look at, you know, for example, there's the full range of them. There's the one the Haas brought to COTA, which got them absolutely nowhere. There was the one AlphaTauri brought a little bit later, which made a jump forward. You know, that those later updates, I think, show what a great job McLaren did there. They've got a problem in the long term, which is, you know, you've got Oscar Piastri, who has come into that team and looks every bit as quick for me as Lando Norris. I had the great pleasure of listening to Zach Brown and Alain Prost at an event a couple of weeks back. And those two sitting there remind you of the good old days of McLaren having a very serious teammate rivalry. And I think their biggest challenge into the future, if they can maintain the performance of that car, is going to be keeping those two very ambitious young racing drivers out of the side of each other in a way which they didn't have to so much this year, because Piastri, as the incumbent rookie, sort of took a natural step back. But he's describing this season as what he hopes will be his last ever season being considered as a rookie or a young driver ever. And that demonstrates where they're at moving forward.
Yes, it's a juicy, evolving storyline, that one, isn't it, between those two? Mark, I mean, Norris, he's always been very honest about pointing out his own errors and his own mistakes. It's part of the endearing qualities of him. But he also showed this year that he responded to that threat from Piastri. And I thought he looked like a top-line driver in a car that's not quite there, but he's getting there. What was your summary of Norris's season?
Yeah, I think for the last two or three years, really, Norris has been, world champion caliber of driver, just not with a car that's not quite there yet. He's ready to fight for titles. Absolutely, he's every time he's there, he gets everything there is to get from the car, in the race and in qualifying. And as you say, he nitpicks at the odd little error, and I think he's getting a bit more wound up by the fact that he still hasn't won a Grand Prix and all these, but that'll just dissolve as soon as he does so, I'm sure. And for me, you could compare him to anyone.
Yeah. Let's move on to Aston, and particularly Fernando Alonso, which is just wonderful to see him still fighting the way he always has throughout his career. But that was a team that started the season second best, really, to Red Bull and looking very strong. And they slipped to fourth in the final points. With a very strange sort of season after the summer break, really. Mark, what went wrong there for Aston, do you think?
Very difficult to call it. They had a transposed season to McLaren, didn't they? Almost at the same time as McLaren came good, Aston dropped off the pace. And the way that they dropped off the pace, it was after Spain and pretty much for the rest of the season. It was odd because they lost something like, if you just compare them to the front of the field, they lost something like 0.3 seconds all in one chunk. So either everybody else improved by 0.3 seconds at the exact same time, or something happened to their car. And they say they just lost the way on the development direction. But even that doesn't really stack up very well, because you would then just revert, wouldn't you? And try and find out what had gone wrong. And then you'd go on from there. And I think essentially when they brought the update for Zandvoort, a lot of that was actually reversing the Canada update. But by that time, the others have moved on. And so it improved things, but not to the extent that it put them where they were. And up before Spain, there was, I don't think there's any question. It was the second fastest car overall. It was as a combination of a race and qualifying. But after that, it really did lose something, and there's all sorts of theories which they absolutely rebuff, saying it was to do with the FIA tightening down on wing flexibility and stuff like that, and they say absolutely not. It's not changed in that way. So I can't give you a definitive answer, but something happened.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they respond to that and what they learned from that experience this year, I guess. But Alex, in terms of Alonso, I mean, what can we say about this guy? It's 20 years since that first Formula One win in Hungary for Renault. 20 years. I mean, an F1 career, and he's still this incredible force. What did you make of Alonso this year?
What impressed me most about Fernando was actually the end of the year rather than the beginning. There's a tremendous recency bias, I realised, when I watched all of the reviews back this morning. And you forget just how good Aston Martin were at the beginning of the year and how routinely they were on the podium. The Fernando Alonso fight back, though, after... And I spoke to Felipe Drugovic right in the middle of that period in Hungary, after Spain and before the Dutch Grand Prix. And I said, what's going on, Felipe? And we had a reasonably long and slightly opaque conversation where he was deciding how much he could tell me. But it approximated to we went for gold and made it slower, and now we've lost so much time we've probably run out of time and money to make it fast again was the fundamental point. But I mean, early on in the season, you know, cutting underneath Hamilton in Bahrain, brilliant stuff, high stakes podium again at the end of the year to drag them back into it past Perez and into Lagos. He's just a bit of a marvel, isn't he, Fernando? I love the way he races, and yeah, he's a legend of the sport.
There was a lovely moment between Perez and Alonso after that race, when Alonso was in the interview pen and Perez came up behind him and just gave him a bit of a hug. And, you know, there's a moment between two racers. You know, obviously Perez was under a lot of pressure, a lot of criticism coming his way, but there was a lovely little pure moment of recognition between the two of them there.
Yeah, and he's a true sportsman, Fernando. You know, I started next to him at a fun race he did at the Daytona 24 Hours in an LMP2 car. And it must have been one of the lowest key races he'd done for years. And he raced everyone in that field with respect, but with intensity with 24 hours to go. He's a sportsman like that. He loves racing for racing, I genuinely believe. And again, yeah, it's lovely to see him support the driver. Again, another lovely moment at the end of the year with Lewis Hamilton, where he goes in the media pen, where he goes, Fernando's getting a little bit old now, and Fernando just gives him a whack. And but on track, there's no one harder to be alongside.
Absolutely. Now, I think when I was speaking about Aston just now, I think I said they were fourth. Obviously, they were fifth. So that means we managed to complete 5 of the 10 F1 teams in the time that allocated for this first part of the Motorsport podcast. Completely predictable, but completely failed to talk about the second half of the grid. Let's come back to some of those themes in part two. But we'll leave it there for now in terms of part one of this motorsport season review. We'll come back to part two, which will be with you very soon. Mark and Alex, you'll be joining us for part two. But for now, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you all for listening.
The Motorsport Season Review Awards, in association with Pocker 1/8 Model Kits.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.